everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors for you. At the top here, CSS DevConf is coming up. That is the name of the conference and the URL. That's CSSDevConf.com. It's coming up this later this October, October 26th through 28th, out in Long Beach, California. It's an Environments for Humans, an in-person conference on this cool boat. So check that out. We'll tell you more about it later in the show. And Velocity Conference, welcome, first-time sponsor. It is, as Dave put it, the one where all the speed freaks go to, which kind of makes sense, right? Velocity, speed. But they talk about lots of different stuff. It's kind of a conference around continuous delivery, DevOps, performance, web operations, that kind of thing. This has a coupon code ST20 for 20% off your registration. We'll tell you more about these kind of excellent conferences later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Listening to Shop Talk Show, the only singing and web design podcast in existence. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
This is a rapid fire show, which means no guests, no drama, no nothing. Just getting into the questions as fast as you can. This is the 48th one, so no surprise there. We kind of like them. We mentioned last one that we are probably going to maybe think about doing the 2-minute timer version again, which means we do extra many of them because
2-minute timer.
So we'll read the question and then I'll start a timer for 2 minutes. And if it ends up, we'll just go to the next one because that's the, I don't know, then we can get to more questions. It just, you know, it works out once in a while. We don't do it every time, but, and it turns out if you Google the word timer, you get a timer in Google. So thanks. Thanks, Google.
Thanks, Google. Cool. Well, all right. Well, shall we get going? I have actually, I messed up. So let's do, I didn't send myself a URL. That was silly. Okay. But I, first question comes from Audrey, Andrew Viney. After designing and creating a website on a Mac and getting everything looking pretty, I'm always getting bit disappointed when I come to look at the site on a PC. I find the font smoothing and color management on OS X and everything make or look substantially nicer, particularly at font face fonts on OS X. Adding a subtle text shadow to everything helps a bit. Are there any plugins or tools to improve font smoothing on other users on user screens? If not, is there anything to take care of? You take care to avoid at the design stage to make the differences less apparent in the end product. Hopefully that makes sense. Having trouble with fonts between PC and
color as well, it sounds like. Well, we did just have Tim Brown on, and he talked a bit about the differences between different operating systems and fonts and stuff, so maybe that's worth listening to. But also, you know, I think even as Tim mentioned, that fonts tend to look a little thicker, whether they're at font face or not, between on a Mac versus a PC. But also, Andrew, I mean, take care to know that you've been looking at your Mac screen now for a long, long time. And you just popped over to a PC real quick to look and you're like, oh, it's different. I don't like it. You know, I think that's normal. And maybe you can set aside any, you know, I'm used to this look and now I'm looking at a different look kind of first reaction judgment. Even if you were to set that aside, and be totally pragmatic and be like, nope, I have declared that the PC version is empirically worse than the Mac version. Still, the people that look at their PC day in and day out and day in and day out are probably kind of used to the way that fonts look on it. So even if you've decided it looks worse, I feel like maybe it's not so bad for people that are kind of used to that way that fonts look. So it's okay that you prefer it, but I'm not sure that I would add a text shadow to every font on my entire website to make it look more Mac-like just for your own like aesthetic desires. You know, it seems like a little heavy of a solution to
Yeah, I wouldn't use Text Shadow, and it doesn't work in IE anyway. So, or Edge maybe even. And yeah, I think like OS X just has OS 10, I guess you call it, has a kind of heavier anti-aliasing. You can mess with the subpixel anti-aliasing or the font smoothing grayscale sort of stuff, but really I think the kind of best practice is sort of not touching that at all, and let the browser render. You can dodge bullets in the design phase by not using like 100 font weight fonts everywhere. They
sure, like if you're particular at font face has that available, don't use it. Yeah,
like don't go too light, and that's, it's tempting because it looks really nice. It's kind of the style, but like if you can avoid it, don't do it, because it'll, like if you're looking at a thin font on OS 10, you're gonna look real thin. Very yeah. I think like, oh, in the versions of the font you're using matter too. Like if you use the wrong font or wrongly hinted font.
Yeah. We probably don't need to deep dive into that. Just let it be. Don't use too thin of things, Andrew. Let's do another one.
Here. Oh, hi. Let me pull up the audio question I meant to bring up earlier because I failed. So here we go. We are loading, redirecting, now loading. And
hey, Chris and Dave. Love the show. My name is Sean, and I'm a web designer and developer. And my question is about HTML5 frameworks like Twitter Bootstrap and Zurb Foundation and customizing them. So I found that working with those frameworks, while they give you a great head start, I love it. But once you get into a little bit deeper in the presentation and really customizing a site or building a site from scratch is what I'm used to doing. So moving to a framework gives me that great head start. But then when I start to get into the deeper elements of the presentation and the design of the site, so now I'm challenged with which way do I customize these frameworks if I want to go that direction. So my initial thought was to use overrides, but then sometimes you're defining styles twice, and that seems sort of silly. And I'm not real keen on just on using overrides in that fashion. The other way would be, I guess, to own the file. So you're using the, Twitter Bootstrap, and you've got, whether it's the SAS files or the LESS files, and then you're modifying the, or just the straight CSS, and you're modifying those, and then you're owning them. So now you can't just upgrade, if Twitter Bootstrap comes out with the next version, you can't just upgrade it. You've got to now, integrate your changes as well.
Here, let's stop there because we kind of already have a couple of few questions to deal with, huh? So how do you customize a out-of-the-box framework?
And then, we've also had Mark Otto on from the Bootstrap legacy and who said on the show that he doesn't really care how you use Bootstrap. So if you want to use it as a starting point and customize it, fine. I think that's legitimate. If you want to override it, that kind of seems fine too. But you're right. It does seem a little funny to use this giant every single bit of Bootstrap and then be like, oh, I want to change something. I'm going to write my own CSS on top of that overrides what's already there. That seems like it's just, it's extra code and it's extra work for the browser to figure out what you're trying to do and stuff. It seems more reasonable that you'd customize it instead of leaving Bootstrap exactly 100% how it is. But doesn't it? I mean, Bootstrap comes with a bunch of variables and stuff. It does seem like the intention of it is to customize it in a sense.
Yeah, I think everyone who runs one of these would say, yeah, download the files and then change them. I mean, if it's colors and fonts that you're changing, and maybe then they actually do that pretty easily with the variables. I mean, modern framework will have a list of variables that you can kind of go through and change to your colors and border.
So what about this upgrades thing then though? Like what, if a new version comes out, do you just kind of ignore it? Like what does an upgrade path look like?
Like my minor updates are very like low, but like Bootstrap 1 to, or let's say Bootstrap 3 to Bootstrap 4 will be significant. It's, you're going from maybe from LESS to SAS or something like that, or from That's a breaking change. Anytime the SEMVAR version jumps a full point, that's a breaking change. That means stuff will probably break and you have to go fix it. So, and that's a manual process. That is, difficult.
But it would be hard anyway. Like, I don't think that you could trust, you know, even if it wasn't major breaking changes, I don't know that you can just like replace exactly what's, you know, the bootstrap.css with the brand new version of it and expect that your changes are still going to apply in the same exact way. I still think it's still a bit of a manual process. So I'd say, you know, just customize it and deal with upgrades when it comes. I think this upgrading thing is occasionally a bit of a problem that is theoretical.
Yeah, I mean, most websites don't get upgraded, so so the mythical upgrade process, could we call that? Yeah. But I think it is going to be tough. I mean, what I like to do anytime I'm using a framework is try to get a sense of when things are going to change. Like right now I'm using Rails for the totally different framework, but a backend framework nonetheless, code I didn't write. I know they're about to upgrade to Rails 5, and I'm like, oh, nerds, I should have looked into that, like how long, you know, the version 5 was kind of away. So that could just be as easy as like poking around GitHub and just looking at the milestones. Because, you know, if you're about to hit a major milestone or they look like they're pushing towards one, then you want to, kind of maybe wait or, you know, start working on a bleeding edge version so that you can upgrade real nicely. So
sounds good. Let's do another one here. Mr. Kevin Croak writes in, how do you feel about condensing information into swiping carousel on mobile devices? Basically, if a site has, say, 3 columns of informational text on a desktop, it will turn into 1 column, but a carousel with swiping functionality on mobile. Some designers like it because it provides more interactive, fun experience on mobile, as well as helping balance and shorten the page length, like the page height, I think. I feel like this has the same principle of regular hero-sized carousels and the fact that no one uses them. Or he said, I guess it's a fairly rare design pattern. Also, hiding content like that is just bad, right? Is it hidden content? I mean, it just seems like it's so hard to talk about with no context whatsoever. That's why design is such a tricky thing. It's so hard to just say, nope, this is a bad thing to do. Don't ever do it. Done.
Should my couch go by my window?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So like, okay, maybe the content is quote unquote hidden, but maybe there's a very clear, you know, kind of arrow. Maybe the design of it is such as that there's drop shadows hanging off in certain places that makes it seem very inviting and very obvious of what you can do. Swiping indeed isn't a particularly rare option to ask people to do on mobile devices. So it seems like it could be kind of cool. You know, why not? I mean, of course, it does take some JavaScript and stuff to get there, although temporarily, I guess. Have you seen that new CSS snap points stuff that's coming?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's pretty good. So maybe this stuff will become easier and easier and easier. And honestly, even Overflow X Auto isn't so bad, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. It's sort of like super manual tabs, right? Like right. The information is hidden and you have to physically swipe the window to see the next tab. Sure. And
there's even CSS ways to pull that off as well. But I wouldn't just crucify this as an idea. I think that's a perfectly fine way to approach certain things in certain areas. But if it's superfluous, if it's allowing people to just add extra crap on the page because they can, because now it's easier to fit on there, that's bad, you know? So just like everything, it depends.
I always think of like Steve Krug's Don't Make Me Rocket Ship or whatever it is.
That's the one. That's think. It. Yeah.
where it's just like, if it's not super obvious, they'll never find it, you know? And that's sort of where carousels come in, you know? Like, that's why you probably need some dots or something or arrows or, you know?
Yeah,
like,
make it obvious. Like, make it obvious. Don't crucify the pattern itself, though. That's not the right discussion to have.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it's obvious, awesome. And it could actually be really weird. I think like whole articles is just from like not knowing anything. I think that's a little weird. Like usually it's in some kind of card context or something like that. You know, like I'm just swiping cards. But like when it's like, I don't know, like I'm paginating articles with a left swipe, I think that's weird to me, and it's got to be really good. If I'm trying to vertically scroll an article and it's sliding left and right, I'm going to be pissed and I'm going to bounce. So don't do that.
Also do a good job, is Dave's point.
Yeah. Also do your dang job.
We lost our minds. I think that was a funny Trent tweet the other day when it was like the Apple Music site had just like white on white text. It's like, oh my gosh, sometimes it feels like we've come so far and sometimes it feels like we're just starting over again.
Are we just, we're just reinventing, not reinventing the wheel, reinventing the worst. All right, next question.
Well, speaking of like leveling up and learning to not repeat our old mistakes and be better at our jobs instead of worse, one of those things that you could do is go to the CSS DevConf. It's sponsor time. I feel like we should have music. Maybe I'll just bang on my keyboard a little bit. But
I'll get a banjo. I'll be right back. Okay, keep talking.
Sure. I'll talk really slow. The CSS DevConf is returning for its fourth year to Long Beach, California. It's going to be on the Queen Mary boat, which is this giant awesome boat thing. There's Dave in the background. So the sessions for it are really cool. By the way, me and Dave will be there both giving presentations. The sessions, the other sessions, we're kind of, you know, there's a couple of keynotes that we just like, unfortunately, me and Dave got to skip the line there, but there's a lot more presentations, that are double blind picked, which is pretty cool. Like they just are chosen by the community without seeing who was in charge of that talk. So, they were voted on by the merit of their talk, which is pretty cool. So, your registration includes breakfast and lunch and snacks and stuff, you know, and you stay on the Queen Mary itself. And, you know, it's all pretty, pretty darn cool thing. It's coming up this October 26th through 28th. The URL for it is csdevconf.com. I think it's going to be darn fun. Look at watch Dave in his boat shoes. Okay. Thanks.
All right, shall we? That was kind of okay.
It was fantastic.
All right. Hey, whatever. The old banjo interlude will tell you that it is advertisement time. All right, here we go. Next question is an audio question. Favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show from RJ LeCount.
Hey, Chris and Dave. My name's RJ. I'm a web designer and front-end developer over in Seattle. I finally took the plunge into SaaS after hearing you guys talk about how awesome it is, and I've used it for a couple of little projects so far. Now, the first thing I did after finding out I could finally use @import without the performance consequences is to set up my main style.scss file with nothing but @imports, @import reset, @import fonts, @import header, and I'd keep separate style sheets in a partials directory for each section of my CSS. This seems like an organized way to handle things, but I also know that the way I write and organize code in any language these days is way more refined than when I first started learning it. So my question for you is sort of open-ended. I was just hoping to get a little window into what your organization style and workflow is like with SAS. Do you keep separate style sheets and import them all? Do you keep everything organized in one file, like classic CSS? I'd just like to get some advice from someone who's been through the ropes a little bit and can help me write code that I won't cringe at when I look back at it years from now. Thanks for the advice and love the show.
All right. Well,
so it's kind of SAS organization is the idea.
Yeah. First of all, if you're writing code that you won't cringe at, please let me know because after making websites for whatever 20 years,
that's fairly impossible. Yeah.
So,
but for what you're saying, it's been a number of years I've been using SAS, and I do it the exact same way that you're doing it, RJ. I just kind of arbitrarily break up the SAS into smaller files. I don't know. There's probably some kind of programmatic concept at work there, but I think it's just kind of matches how your brain works in a sense. I mean, you can just break things apart arbitrarily just for your own organizational feel goods, I think, is the idea there. I'm not sure that there's one way is any better than any other way particularly. And I think that's what's so kind of great about this ability to break things apart arbitrarily is because it can match your brain flow. So that's how mine works too. I have a typography file. I break it into header and footer and navigation and stuff. And I just do it based on how I know that I might look for it later, you know? I can jump into any one of my projects and be like, you know what, where's the navigation CSS again? Oh, I'm just going to hit Command T, you know, which brings open the like little file finder thing. And it's probably, I probably called it like nav SCSS or something. Oh, look, there it is. Oh, I found it, you know? And that's the advantage of the partial. Less scrolling around the files. It's a little easier to navigate the file. And it's named something that you would name it. What do you got, Dave?
Oh, I was just going to say, I have an app I'm working on, gotatrip.com, sent up today. You only, Austin, you only, and like, yeah, it's whatever you want. Like, I have an animations CSS file. I have a base, which is really just like global HTML kind of reset. That's like my own custom reset. I have a thing called blocks, which is really dumb, but any kind of like big old block on the page, like a header, page header, or like a media component. I kind of made a blocks, and that's new, but that might get broken up in 2 weeks. You know, I have a buttons, a forms, a grid, a list, which is like, I have four different kinds of lists, and I just made a bunch of lists in, you know, styles in there. I have a narrow style sheet, which is like a body class where the page is narrow and everything kind of changes. Notifications, a special little partial for onboarding, a site header, site footer, variables.
Can you tell that that's just matching how Dave's mind works a little bit? I think that's kind of the a perfectly appropriate way to approach this.
Mm-hmm. And then I have another file for like when there's major divergences, like the home page, the like little marketing page is way different than the application page. So I have a home SCSS that's not underscored. It's a full CSS file.
Yeah, exactly. And
that could be totally broken up, but it's just, you know, it's maybe I'm looking at it like 400 lines of code, 500 lines of code. So it's like, that's, I don't know, that doesn't need to get broken up for its use. And that's probably going away in the future. So I don't worry about it. So,
all right. We have Johnny Nugent who wrote in, I want to be able to select LIs like I would select files on my desktop. You know, maybe there's some drag and select, but I think mostly it's click, 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 click is what he's looking for. I looked at jQuery UI, but it doesn't support the shift key for multiple select. What up with that? If you have any suggestions for a plugin that could help me out. So he wants to be able to like, you know, maybe imagine just a list of things, you know, list like thing, 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 thing. You click on one and it highlights or something. And then you click on another one, and it would unhighlight the first one and highlight the second one. Unless you were holding down the shift key, then if you clicked on the second one, it would add. They would both become selected. That seems like a reasonable thing to do. Certainly something you could write yourself if you want to, but he's kind of looking at a library. Johnny linked to the ticket for jQuery UI that says that's not supporting the shift key. And it's not just that they don't support the shift key. They on purpose don't support the shift key. What they do support is the meta key, which is the, you know, it's the command key on Macs and it's the control key on PCs. And they linked to why they did that way and then marked this ticket as won't fix because they thought it out and decided that they're not supporting the shift key. They're supporting it because it's better. It's just easier to maintain and makes more sense in a cross platform kind of way. So it's like, how much do you care about this shift key thing? I feel like they've put a lot of thought behind how multiple selects should work on the web. And I would lean towards just using their thing and kind of leaning towards that expertise.
Yeah, I would probably like surrender the feature, you know, and get just use something that exists just so it gets out there and then circle around. But I can't, you know, it's been a long time since I've done any kind of file browser file tree kind of thing. So it's really tough. And I'm even thinking of like a finder where you have like multiple icons.
I know that
he's
saying it's exactly files. It's just like it's just a general select kind of interface, whatever that happens to be. He wants to be able to use the shift key to select multiple things. I mean, clear, you know, so if you're talking about event handlers, you can, and you're, it's a click or something. When you do add an event handler for a click, you get the event object, and the event object will tell you what modifier keys were also held down when that event happened. So it shouldn't be particularly difficult if you wanted to write your own that just was like, I see, a click happened. Was the modifier key on or not? Mm-hmm. And then if it was, then trigger your and which modifier key was it? The shift key. It seems like something that you could do yourself if you really wanted to. And I'm sure that jQuery UI is moddable and such that you could get it done that way as well if you're already using that framework.
Hmm. Yeah, I think. Yeah, it looks like there's even like a shift key property or spec kind of thing. So if you were like mouse event or whatever plus and then you held shift key like shift mouse click, looks like there's something like that being proposed. I don't know how far out it is. So it's in DOM level 3 specification. That seems like it should have landed. So since we're on like DOM 4 right now, maybe, I don't know. So that might be kind of helpful.
Yep. Here we go.
You might just have to write like a custom little thing to handle multiple, but it could also like if jQuery UI is saying it's hard and a nightmare, then it might be hard and a nightmare. Yeah. And that's where
I don't know if they're saying it's hard. They're just saying it's not. That's a Mac thing. And why do everything so Mac-y? Anyway, we got here one from Joe Proctor.
Hi guys. Really love the show. Really inspiring. Aw, thanks, Joe. I have a question about basically uploading a site to the web. I work locally with a local host and then put my files online via FTP. I've heard you mention that this is outdated and not the best practice. What are the best alternatives to FTP and what are the benefits over FTP? Cheers.
It's not that FTP is outdated necessarily. It's still ultimately the way that files generally move around on the web. It's just that using it directly isn't always the best idea, Joe. And I think the reason we've mentioned that in the past is because imagine that instead of just working by yourself, you're working with a friend as well. And you upload header.php up to your site. And they're like, oh, I was working on header.php too. And FTP doesn't really have any mechanisms for being like, this has changed since the last time you updated it kind of thing. It's just like, no, it's just going to override it. You know, there's no system for making sure that that type of stuff doesn't happen. And that's why we kind of have in the past advocated that you don't just generally just wipe stuff up to FTP and call it a day kind of thing. If you're working alone, perhaps that's fine, but that breaks down the second you have somebody else in there. Plus, it doesn't track any of your changes. It's not particularly easy to roll back things if you screwed something up. And that's where version control comes in. But still, the underlying technology of moving things up to your server probably is FTP still. So anything to add to that, Dave?
Yeah, like FTP, yeah, it's still like a transfer protocol. That's all it is. But the human error aspect of it is very high. One of the reasons I use a technology called rsync, which is kind of FTP, but it's basically I have a script that will SSH into my server. So it goes in, does a handshake, says, cool, you're the boss of this server. And then I use rsync, which is if you think about how like your iCloud syncs or something like that, it's basically that. It basically goes through every file and say, hey, have you changed? Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let's get the latest one. Okay, have you changed? Okay, yes, I have. And then, oh, you haven't changed, you haven't changed, you haven't changed. So it sort of takes Dave Rupert LLC Dave Rupert, the developer, has to quit remembering every single file he's changed and only upload those files. So that's sort of the trick I run with. And it's really fast. That's the thing too, is if I tried to like drag and drop and upload, it would take a very long time. But rsync is just like, pew, 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 done.
Oh. And Joe, you're already working locally anyway on localhost. That's a good step anyway. That means you can do things like have local build processes and use preprocessors and all that kind of fun stuff. So it seems like since you're doing that anyway, it's not too much of a hop and a skip there to, for one, do some backups on your localhost. Keep that stuff in Dropbox or have some kind of backup solution. And two, just get yourself on some version control of some kind, which will be a backup as well as kind of bring in some some workflow benefits. All right, we got one from Danilo Vega here. I've always styled the default state for links using the element selector. So just a curly bracket, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I've always wondered about the pseudo class link, so colon link. Its default function is to style links that are in their default state. Maybe I should just be styling using that instead of A, you know, use link instead of A, instead of the anchor element. Then I wouldn't have conflicting styles and the need to overwrite styles when using an anchor for wrapping divs and getting rid of those link styles. First we could talk about link a little bit. I think there's might be some trouble with that last statement there, though. Do you ever use link, Dave? Does it enter your style sheets?
No, never.
Yeah, never for me either. Just because I don't think it's particularly useful. It has a little bit of higher specificity than A does. It would be, you know, infinitely higher, really, because it's, you know, it'd be like 0, 1 instead of 1, 0. It does only select anchor tags that have an href attribute on them, I'm pretty sure. So it's a little bit like bracket href bracket as far as what it selects, and those would have the same specificity. So if you did ever want to use A tags for some reason that didn't have hrefs on there, it wouldn't select those, although that seems like invalid and weird and not particularly useful. I don't think link is very useful as a thing. Daniel says at the end here, I wouldn't have conflicting styles and I wouldn't need to overwrite styles when using an anchor for wrapping divs and stuff. When I saw this, I was like, that seems weird. So like imagine you have occasionally, you know, you have anchor styles. So you might go like A color red or something. All the links on my site are going to be red. But then you have like occasionally you want maybe like a whole media block to be clickable. So it has like an image inside. It has an H3 tag inside. It's got a P inside. And you kind of want that whole area to be clickable maybe because it's just a little preview for an article or something. So you wrap an A around the whole thing. I think Danilo's thinking here that that A color red, if you used link, wouldn't bleed onto the H3 or something. Because of, I don't know why, but it does though. So sorry. Yeah, I don't know. Like it doesn't solve, I don't think it solves anything that you might be thinking that it solves. I largely think link is pretty darn useless. So if somebody has any, wants to dispute that argument, I'd be happy to hear
it. If the writer of the spec would like to write it and tell us why it exists. I don't really know why. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just to say, like, you're just explicit about the default, you know, so.
Or it's a specificity thing where they want to make sure that there's some kind of selector that selects all of them that has the same specificity as the rest. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, maybe you're just not, I don't know. Or let's say you're doing like on link, you're doing like a little dot out to the side, like content after with a little dot to say, hey, this is unread or something. And you don't want to like remove that, like write a content after for every single like state after that, maybe. But that seems, I just wouldn't worry about it. I style off of the A. I feel like you need a good, strong base style.
Maybe it'll be useful later when like other attributes can be links. Like if it was like href everywhere has been a little thing that kind of comes up once in a while. That's like, why can't any element ultimately be an anchor? So like div href, and then you could go div link for styles. That'd be kind of useful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, next question.
Andrew Threadgrill writes in, I graduated with a comp sci degree, but found that I love web design as well as developing on the back end. I'm sort of a one-man show, I guess. Is there anyone out there that does this, or is there always a clear-cut break between the front end and back end? Is it good to blur these lines? Congratulations, Andrew. You are a unicorn.
Cheesy name. That has kind of entered the vernacular a little bit. Hopefully it will go away soon because it's totally dumb. But that is what they call people that are kind of transcend or blur the lines, as you put it.
I think there are actually a lot of people. I can name probably like 10 friends that have a computer science degree. They did like Java, you know, but they just end up, they love designing and kind of developing mobile apps, like the interfaces. And then they also have the chops to develop the back end. That's like a seriously amazing skill. And I think a lot of companies desire that. I think the question is always like, everyone wants a 10x unicorn developer, but then they're like, but do you really, you know, like it's like, yeah, actually I do all these things. I'm kind of maybe a little not, I'm maybe mediocre in some departments, but I do it all, you know, and right. I think people find that unbelievable.
Dave, you're very much like this. You know, I think I have it to it. You are a little higher than me, but I think we both have a little bit of experience in both sides and stuff. And it's darn mm-hmm. useful, wouldn't you say? I mean, I would highly encourage Andrew to keep pursuing this. If you know that you already like both things and like leveling up in both things and stuff, definitely keep pursuing that. It definitely makes you more well-rounded and useful. And it means that you're not, you know, you're staying true to yourself. I mean, if you already know you like these things, then keep liking them. Dang it.
I overheard Rebecca Murphy and Una Kravitz Twitter conversation, and I think Rebecca Murphy had said, be a generalist as long as you can, like until somebody like pays you to be a specialist. Mm. And I found that to be really amazing advice. I mean, like just do it all until somebody's like, I need you to do this, you know? 'Cause man, it seems very, you know, I don't know. It seems like very good job insurance. Am I crazy to think that? Just like if somebody's like, if I do everything and it's like, you know what? I make video games now. I'm pulling a Nick Pettit and I make video games now. That's kind of a cool, that's an upward mobility, I think. So
we'll be hiring at CodePen soon. And I dang right. I want generalists.
Yep. See, there you go. This is a good time to mention shoptalkshow.com/jobs. You can just like have a look around there. Look how many people are like looking for either front end or back end, but then like look at the bonuses and they're like, it'd be awesome if you knew, you know, Ruby on Rails. Right. It's like, yeah, crack knuckles. I got it. So, all right. Andrew Heiberg writes in, I would like to know if there is any workarounds for pixel rounding as well as floating point rounders in browsers. My problem occurs when I make fluid grids. All browsers seem to round floating points differently, which makes the grid inconsistent across browsers. So have you seen this, Chris, where the browsers just quit rounding?
I think it comes up most often when you have weird, it's percentages generally, right? It's mm-hmm. not, it's not like, you know, width equals 25 pixels in browsers that have trouble with that. It's 25%, and probably not 25%, but it's probably more like when you do those super weird RWD calculations, like 13.6839777% or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then it's like one browser will, have it be one less pixel than another one. That's what Andreas is talking about, is the different browsers making different decisions about which way to go with that one pixel generally. And one pixel can be a problem, especially if those grids, for example, a column has a different background color than what's behind it. Then you're like, oh shoot, now I can see color peeking through in this browser where I couldn't in this other browser. If there is no color change, you probably won't even notice it. It's probably fine.
Yeah.
But when color changes happen, it can be kind of a bummer. So I'm not sure that I have a particular solution for it. One of them might be not using weird numbers like that when you can. So if you need like a four-column grid, get the four columns through 25% columns and then use padding internally somehow to get the columns that you need in between, because browsers won't have a problem probably with 25%. That's one possible solution, or, you know, use Flexbox when you can. That's like a little bit more, browsers have worked on that more recently. So I feel like it's kind of less of a problem these days. I'm not sure that I don't think there's any library that you can install that fixes it across browsers or whatever, but it's either getting used to it or using something else.
Yeah. So historically Opera was the worst, right? It went from like Chrome is pretty good. Firefox is maybe the best. Chrome's pretty good. Safari had some problems, and then Opera was terrible, but that's all kind of changed with Blink. So now Safari's kind of on the lower end of subpixel rendering and rounding. In my humble opinion,
it's kind of going away as a problem.
It's kind of going away. You'll still experience it. And if you're supporting older browsers like IE8 and stuff like that with percentages, which like, bless your heart. But the easiest thing I've found to do is just round down all the percentages, or maybe even shave off a whole number and just let it lie.
Because what you don't want is for it to round up or whatever and break.
And break to the next line. So I have whole IE8 style sheets dedicated to redoing the grid. And that's, you know, and a lot of people, yeah. I mean, some people hate grid classes, but man, I love them for that reason. Like just because I can like smash the grid in one fell swoop. I don't have to like dig through everything. So, so that's what I would recommend.
Good luck, Andreas. Ben Robertson writes in, the agency I am working at is starting to move more towards modular SCSS, following the SMAX model, the Jonathan Snook thing. Jonathan says that media queries should go next to the module they affect in the CSS. I think this approach will be way easier to maintain since all the code for that module will be in one place. I've also heard people mention that this will lead to massive code bloat and performance issues. Are there performance issues with this? What kind of organizational model do you all follow with your SCSS to help maintainability? Just to set the stage here a little bit, imagine you had dot module curly brackets. You know, you're writing some CSS, and then at certain media query breaks, you want some things to change there. You want it to be, well, like instead of with 25%, it's with 100% or something at a break. So what Ben is talking about is, and what Jonathan has suggested, is that you, because SAS allows this, you can write the media query not only right next to it, but you could write it right within that dot module selector. So it's called nested media queries, and it's pretty darn nice way to work. In fact, you know, if we were listing out the best features of SAS, it would probably be at imports that we already talked about in this show, because that's darn nice. And nested media queries are right up there near the top of being useful.
Yeah.
Because of exactly what you said, Ben, that allows you to keep that styling kind of right next to each other instead of really kind of far apart in the file. And the performance issue that you mentioned is the fact that when your SCSS compiles, it will not squish all those media queries together. It will kind of leave them right where they are in the code. It will bubble them out, but it'll still bubble them out right next to each other. So you might run up in your final compiled code, you might have 50 media queries that are exactly the same and scattered throughout your final CSS file. That's kind of a bummer because you would never have written it that way by yourself. It doesn't feel particularly efficient. Now, the general thinking around this is that gzip is going to squish that into nothing, so don't worry about the extra file size. And that browsers don't have any particular problem parsing through that and figuring out what to do with that. It doesn't seem to slow down the page at all. I don't have any URLs to share with you on that, but that's kind of the feeling in the air on that is kind of just like, don't worry about it.
Yeah. Kimberly Blessing, who we've had on the show, she did a talk at the first CSS DevConf.
About have some URLs for you then, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I just posted one in the show notes here, but it basically like there are pros and cons, but the like net is nothing and pretty good test, like literally doesn't matter. So don't worry about it.
Way to go, Kimberly. Put this thing to rest.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, she actually used Microsoft.com, womp womp, which I worked on. Anyway, so it's interesting to see like your own website on their little test there. But yeah, it's interesting. I think, yeah, putting it to bed, like it doesn't, you know, the computer's smart, the computer will figure it out. Like if you need to just rip out the charts module, again, this is the mythical updating scenario. But if you need to rip out a charts module or something like that, or refactor it, like all the code you need is in one file. You don't have to go hunting through 10 files to figure out this one thing. I think it's the way to go. Yeah. So that's what I would recommend for you.
So if you do, speaking of performance concerns, you should be checking out this. It's Velocity Conference, O'Reilly's Velocity Conference. It is a huge, massive, badass conference. The URL is velocityconf.com. shop.com. It is happening October 12th through 14th in New York City, right in the heart of Midtown. You are there. You are within walking distance of Times Square and the Empire State Building and Broadway and all this stuff. In fact, if you go, you should go see Sleep No More. It's a really cool performance thing that I saw not too long ago, and it was awesome, and I would totally do that again in New York. Velocity is the best conference for web ops. It's for performance professionals. Like we said at the top of the show, this is like, it's kind of like speed conf, you know, velocity conf, get it? You know, it's where the speed freaks go. We have notable speakers like Ilya Grigorik from Google, Tammy Everts from Sosta, Tim Kadlec from Akamai. We've had Tim on the show, a fellow Wisconsin dude. It's an awesome conference for, you know, this is the future. This is a well-timed conference for, like, this is the conversation on the web right now. So how can we get these things fast? Because it matters so much. Use coupon code ST20 for 20% off and all of the ticket that you buy. And they have kind of different packages depending on what you want to do, what you want to see, how you want to do things at Velocity in New York. VelocityConf.com. All righty. Let's see. Who else can we help?
All right. We have Jake Alba, right, calling in.
Hey, guys. I work for a small design and development agency. We're planning on redesigning our archaic website. How we build it is primarily up to me. The content will consist of media-rich case studies. It's currently on WordPress. Keeping it updated becomes so overwhelming and cumbersome that it never seems to happen. I'm considering using Jekyll or perhaps some other static site compiler. Everyone in the company knows how to write Markdown, and I feel that keeping the content updated via YAML or JSON would actually end up saving time. The whole site could be stored in a Git repo and in my mind be much more flexible moving forward. Are there other compilers like Jekyll that I should consider? Is there anything you have found overwhelmingly difficult with this approach? Static files seem unprogressive, yet in many ways they feel like a breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Definitely met a lot of people that feel that same way about things.
It's interesting to me. This is not Jake specifically, but it's interesting for me. Like when web design agencies go to tackle their own website, it's like, oh.
How can we possibly do this? You know, when they talk to clients, they're like, absolutely, we can do anything.
We are experts. Yeah. We are experts. But when it's like your own site, you're just like, oh God, how am I going to...
How does the website even work? What is happening? That's hilarious.
But that's not just you, Jake. But I will speak from having just gone through all of this. Paravel Inc., we're about to launch a new portfolio. It's probably live, actually, by the time this show goes out. But we had it on WordPress or something, and then we went to some weird PHP thing I made, and then we nuked all that, and we're switching over to Jekyll just because it is awesome and maintainable. And, you know, again, it's kind of back to the whole partials thing. It's like there's one file you work on. It's a partial. It's fine. You know, most people kind of understand it. The problem I've experienced with Jekyll is the kind of onboarding people who aren't familiar with Ruby environments. It takes a good 2-3 hours to install Ruby and Jekyll and kind of explain, okay, you open up the terminal and you drag the folder onto the thing to go to that directory. And then you you have to come up with an easy way to like get people up and running with Jekyll or be really transparent about how you're sharing your Jekyll install with people. So that's where like WordPress has a friendly admin. Jekyll has none of that. So
that's the thing. We're already talking about CMSs when I feel like the conversation should back up a little bit and be like, what is it that's overwhelming and cumbersome about the process of updating your site? It's not WordPress. It's something else. It's that, well, the fields aren't there that make it necessary, or I can't move this thing to this thing, and I wish I could do that or something. You know, like there's a symptom happening here. I don't think it's the software itself. You know, like if WordPress was configured perfectly and you had a custom page type for a case study, and the case study had all these fields set up that were just perfect for any particular case study, and you had plugins that allowed you to drag things around and do whatever you wanted to, I feel like that would be killing it. You know, then WordPress would maybe be perfect for you. Or, you know, I don't think it's like JSON is going to solve your content problem. You know, it's like we're using tech to. It's the revamping of the process. It's the revamping of how you're dealing with content that's going to help you. You know, I always want to frame conversations like that where it's just like, ah, WordPress, that's your problem. That's your whole problem right there. You got to switch to a different, just switch to a different CMS. It'll solve all your content problems immediately.
You got a WordPress gunking up your works. I opened the hood. There's a big old WordPress in there.
I feel like it's the process of moving to something else that's going to get you thinking about your whole process that's going to open things up.
And there's part of that process could be developer convenience. Like if developers don't mind opening up the hood and fixing and updating the website, that's one thing. But it could even just be like a corporate document. Like you set a date, you know, one day every quarter where you guys all just, you know, or 2 days where you guys say, hey, we're going to update the website, fix it, clean it, you know, make us look good. One or 2 days every quarter or trimester or something. And, you know, so that might be the way out of your, what is it? Mismanagement, you know, like you have to, I don't know. It's like getting a haircut. You have to just set a date to get a haircut, right?
I love it. Best metaphor. Zach Piper writes in, I like it when we stop a question at just the right moment. Zach Piper has a question about Gulp. What are the best practices when using Gulp on a team? Should everyone be running the latest versions of Gulp, NPM, SAS, etc.? How should I deal with old Gulp files? Should I update them as I come across them or maintain the same Gulp file across all projects? Do you have any other best practices kind of thing? So Gulp is Gulp.js, the build tool kind of thing. They use it for lots of different projects, it sounds like. There's nothing about... How does that work? Like if we're working on a shared project together, Dave, the version of Gulp is defined in NPM, right? It's if I pull and you've updated Gulp, my version of Gulp will update too, right? But only if I run NPM install.
Yeah, I mean, so when you add it, like NPM install save dev. Like you have to make sure you're doing like the save or save dev. Like I always get confused on the difference, but you have to make sure you do that. And then it'll install a reference to Jekyll or Gulp or some Gulp task and usually put the latest version of that file or the file that it actually installed in your thing. In that package.json. And then you just need to commit that package.json and make sure everyone uses that. If you're getting like out of sync and out of whack, I've seen this kind of happen a lot lately. You'll have to just make sure everyone does like npm install again and make sure when they open it up, they do npm install and then they type Gulp. So
let's go. It seems like that would be reasonable to make sure that everyone has the same versions of things especially things that Gulp does, like SAS. That would be weird if people are on different versions of SAS because the different things could be happening. So yeah, I would definitely, you know, use Slack. Tell people to, you know, if you pull, make sure to update your stuff because that's you know, there's some updates that are going to happen or whatever. That seems reasonable. Should you use the same Gulp file across all projects? That seems like a little too dreamy. Like, I don't know if all your projects are going to be exactly the same. There's going to be file paths that are different and that kind of thing because that makes more sense for that project. If you can pull that off, fine. You know, I definitely know agencies I'm working with, one right now who they have just kind of a standard Gulp setup that they kind of move from project to project. And they were like, oh, hey, I see you're using CodeKit on this. Do you mind if we just use our Gulp setup instead, just because that's how we roll? And they were able to kind of drop it in and it just kind of worked. And I was like, well, that's amazing. Sure, let's use that. So there is kind of a standardization setup. You know, like if you generally keep folders at the same kind of levels and name them the same things and stuff, that might kind of work. What should you do with your old gulp files? I don't know. Like if it's working, just leave it alone, I guess. It seems like, I don't know, I have some old shoes in my closet that probably could use polishing, but I'm probably not going to pull them down and polish them for no reason. You know, I'll polish them when I need to go to the next wedding I need to go to, you know? Like, I don't know that you need to bulk off time to go fix old gulp files that are largely working, you know? It seems like a waste of time.
Yeah. I think this is one of those, like, talking with people would be the best solution for, like, maintaining development environments between team members. Like, talk about your pain points and then, like, try to solve them. Is gulp the problem, or is it, like, people not doing gulp, you know, like, or like people kind of going commando. But ideally these tools like gulp and NPM and SAS and everything, they're set up to enable teams to work on the same things for free. They don't need the latest version of some software. You can use an old version together, or you can use the latest, they're set up to be basically free versions of software that you can use together. So, yeah. So good luck. I would talk it out with your team and try to figure out the pain points around your gulp setup. So, shall we go? One more question here. We got it from Tim Fitzgerald. If you have a huge database-driven web app, is it better to have an incomplete sitemap or none at all? Do you see sitemaps themselves potentially becoming obsolete as search engines get smarter, better at finding their way around? Chris,
yeah, I happen to know. What's that? What do you happen to know?
You run a website with like 32 million pens.
Yeah, we sure as heck don't have a sitemap for them all. I guess there maybe there's some Rails gem that we could use and to have them tell about our, and we could configure it to tell about our content and it would build one. I don't know. Maybe we don't use one. I do use one at CSS Tricks only because the Yoast plugin thingy, the SEO plugin that does some pretty useful stuff, also just makes a sitemap too. So why not? Mm-hmm. Also, I think we had to turn that one off because I don't think it does a good job with BB Press, which is the forums we use on CSS Tricks. So I had to use a different one. So it turned out that was like a major performance problem on CSS Tricks. Is every time you like saved a page, it would rebuild the sitemap, and the sitemap would also rebuild the 40,000 threads.
Articles and threads. Yeah, holy moly.
So we found some different one that was kind of like rsync for sitemaps. It only updated the things that needed, which is pretty good. I have no evidence at all if it's useful. And in fact, I suspect that it's not particularly useful to have a sitemap.
Yeah, I think there's like some benefits, like Google kind of knows you're a real thing, and it can diff what it knows about you versus what you're telling it about it, you know, like they can kind of be like, okay, yeah, but
I'm sure it doesn't hurt unless there's a performance issue.
Yeah. Or like your sitemap is spitting out garbage links, like sure. spam links. And
or if it's 5 megabytes big and the requests for it are slowing down your server.
Yeah. Well, so I noticed, there's actually like, I know this from working with a big company, but there are limits to how many URLs and things that Google will index. And I just did like a quick Stack Overflow thing, and it's 50,000 URLs is the limit, upper limit of what Google will index for your site, and file size 50 megabytes uncompressed. So you're looking at 50 and 50. Max limit for your data, or for your number of links in your website. And so, you're going to have to, it's sort of like if you, let's say you have 100,000 posts on your blog, your BuzzFeed, and you can only choose 50,000. How do you choose those? That's kind of tough too, right? Like just choose the popular ones, I think is probably the right answer, but, how do you do that? I don't know. You guys have more than 50,000 pens. How would you go about indexing those? That's difficult, right?
Yeah. You know what I'm going to do? Ignore it.
Ignore it. Just let Google be Google. Is that
3.8 million pens.
There you go.
Too many. You're just too many over, for a site pap.
You're just over your 50K limit. But that's interesting too, is I rarely have problems searching, like Google searching for code pens, or, you know, I don't know, man. I think it's maybe out of date. I think, but I don't know, but SEO, I wonder people if it helps
Google
say,
Webmaster Tools to, so it, like, it's useful for that internal Google tool thing somehow.
See, yeah, that's probably helpful, because that will crawl your sitemap and say, like, hey, this page has 10 broken links, and Google hates broken links. So don't, link rot's bad for your business. So, you kind of need to have like a certain number of indexes there. Maybe it's just about what it ranks you by. Like, if all your sitemap links are to whatever underwear blog posts, and you don't want to be known for underwear, then you're in trouble. So you'll have to.
Gosh, we had a weird one from somebody on CodePen. They had an iframe embedded pen on there, and their Google Tools was telling them that CTX was the most, the keyword was, that was the heaviest keyword on their website. But it's just because they embedded this one pen in an iframe that used that in the JavaScript, like, you know, 150 times. I was like, what is Google indexing iframes and attributing that to the parent page these days? I'm like, oh, see, I just have no idea how these things work.
Yeah, no, that's it. We should try to get Matt Cutts from Google.
We've tried, actually, but he's just like, I am not taking stuff at the moment, which I totally understand. So yeah, someday we'll get him.
We'll get
or somebody similar. I don't think he's the only person on the earth that can talk about this stuff.
But how much does Paul Irish know about search? We could get Paul. Paul,
I suspect Paul that
answer
much.
All our search questions.
We'll get Paul's uncle.
Paul's uncle on. And Paul's uncle is actually, he's like, oh yeah, you got too many deep links in your system.
It's gunking up the works.
Gunking up the works. And there was 10 rats and a frog in there too. Oh boy. Well, you've been listening to another episode of the Shop Tech Show, a rapid fire episode. If you enjoyed the 2-minute version, we kind of did okay at it, but kind of didn't obey it strictly. But if you hate this style, tough. Sorry. Oh, send me an email at farts.web.com. be sure to follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Download this in your podcast of choice and hit the stars button, 5 stars or whatever, just to rate this up and let your friends know. That's how people find out about the show. We really appreciate anyone who's ever done that in the past. You guys occasionally, I'll go and check in on all those, and it's really nice to see the things y'all say. And yeah, thanks so much. And if you hate your job, go over, get a job at shoptalkshow.com/jobs, because people want to hire you. And Chris, you got anything else?
Book. ChopTalkShow.com.